Welcome to another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. My name is H.F. Mason. I'm a general surgeon and chief quality officer for Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Parsons, vice president of market operations at Baptist.
And I'm Bill Flaut. I'm assistant chief medical officer at Baptist.
Well, guys, today we are so excited and happy to have Bree Groff on the show today. Bree is a senior advisor for SY Partners, a global consultancy company. She has consulted for big name companies such as Microsoft, Calvin Klein, Hilton, Target, Google, among many others. And today we're going to be discussing Bree's book, which is called Today Was Fun, a book about work seriously. And the seriously is in parentheses because a lot of folks, I would say most folks, don't equate work, always equate work with fun. So we're really excited to discuss it. And Bree, tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us how this book came to be.
Sure. Thanks for having me. And yes, as you said, I am a company culture employee experience expert. I have been consulting from everything from the large organizations to growing startups. I've had the privilege of interviewing hundreds of different employees about their experience of work, peeking into dozens of different cultures, and through my professional experience, have really fortunately developed some pattern recognition about what makes a great day at work. That was all well and good, but the book actually comes from a much more soulful part of me. My mother was diagnosed with a terminal cancer in 2022. I took leave from work to care for her until she passed later that year. My father had already had Alzheimer's at that point. I'm an only child. So I was really in the caregiving and this fear of sort of like existential awareness. Because once you have a diagnosis like that, being close to someone who does, I was just much more acutely aware of the value of our days. And you all know within hospital systems, like the goal is more good days. It's just very clear what the goal is. And yet contrast that with, you know, talk to anyone at work and they're like, oh, it's Monday, or oh, is it only Wednesday, or TGIF? You know, it was just so common to wish away the work week. And that felt in many ways sacrilegious to me. Like we are not properly valuing our finite days on the planet. And so my personal experience paired with my professional experience, it inspired me to write this book to hopefully help other people have more good days, even Monday through Friday.
You know, Bree, you had a quote on another podcast that really resounded with me. And it was, what is the point of extending our lives when we're wishing away Monday through Friday? And, you know, we spend, I did a little research, yeah. Americans, we spend about 25% of our waking hours at work or at our jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's so much to be said that, you know, what's the point if we're not enjoying what we do?
Absolutely. Yeah. And like in during the years when we are like well into our careers, right, that, you know, certainly like a quarter across our lives and taking into account sleep. But if we think of like 5/7 of each week, that needs to be more than the input to a paycheck or the input to a company's bottom line, that we are not properly valuing our own experience at work. Because so often we feel like what the department is called, which is human resources, that we are a resource that is being consumed in order to produce something. And so I'm very pro impact, very pro making money too. Like all of these things are good things, but not when we treat the input or our days on the planet as expendable in order to achieve that. And so as you say, like what's the point? What's the point in giving people more days if we're only going to try to get through them?
Hey, Bree, I love this topic and I appreciate you joining us on the podcast. for our listeners and for you as well. I mean, we're a faith-based not-for-profit organization. We really care about our employees. We use the acronym Baptist Cares a lot. And we just accomplished really record highs in employee engagement. We're really proud of that. 85th percentile nationally.
Wow.
And so, again, that's something that we pour a lot into, and we're really proud of that outcome. But my question is, it kind of in this space, I'm really intrigued by this because of already how we've kind of outlined how we think about work most times. And honestly, I came in today kind of thinking about work in a frustrated sense. But is this the organization's responsibility to make work fun, or is this the individual's responsibility for how we show up?
Yeah. So ideally, both. Ideally, the organization takes responsibility and its leaders take responsibility. And if that's just not happening and you know, a listener is like, well, that's not my choice, if the work isn't fun, then you can still do things individually. But I like to focus at the organizational level, the leadership level, because we can think of leadership. Often we use the word leader and manager sometimes interchangeably, because we often think of leadership as I am managing a resource. I'm managing a human resource. I'm trying to extract as much value out of this resource, out of this human as possible. And my job as a manager is to make sure the work is getting done on time. But that's really only one half of management or leadership. The other half is being a steward of these human days. Like, again, speaking existentially, over my career, I've had two team members pass away from cancer that were on my teams. And looking back, wondering whether I extracted the most business value out of them or impact, like, that's the furthest thing from my mind. I'm thinking, was I a good steward of their days on the planet? Like, they ran out of Mondays. The Mondays that I was responsible for, did I do what I could to create an environment where they could call that Monday a good day? And so I think that's the other part of leadership, which is why I say, like, bravo to, like, the incredible engagement scores that you have, because it's a responsibility not to be taken lightly. And then on the other hand of that question, you know, so if someone's like, oh, my company has terrible policies and doesn't care about people, then there's still hope. There's always things that you can do at an individual level to make your day more joyful, especially at the very local level of your team or the few colleagues that you interact with more regularly. I think specifically about the show The Office, which I think many people have seen. You know, you're all in the position to, like, create incredible, profound human impact through health and care. But even if you're just selling paper, there's still an opportunity to create fun in your days. That's always within your power.
Brian, in healthcare, is it easier in healthcare to create days that don't feel wasted because we're dealing with patients, or is it harder, or are we in a better position or a worse position for that?
You're in a different position, different benefits, different challenges. The benefits are obvious, right? Like, you can tie your daily activity to patient outcomes. Even if you work in building operations with, you know, if you're not, like, helping a patient directly, you can still see that you are supporting the system that's helping people to feel better and live better lives. So the meaning, I hope, feels really, really good. The other side of that coin, why it's a different situation, is for the same reason that people say, oh, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. When we hold our work to such high standards that it's our passion, it's our contribution to the world, a lot of times that can come with, one, a lot of stress, and two, a culture of overworking. Because if our work is so important, why aren't we doing it all the time? Isn't it more important to serve the organization and the patients than it is to, say, make it home for dinner on time? Or heaven forbid, like, you know, rest or go to exercise. And so it really is a double-edged sword, which is why it's amazing to care about that impact, but I'm also trying to level out the scales a little bit such that we also invest and take pride in our own enjoyment of our lives, which can feel almost wrong in a way to prioritize our own pleasure and enjoyment at work when the mission is so important. So it's simply different, but I'd be interested if that resonates with all of you or your point of view.
It does. And Bree, I've also heard you talk about, well, here at Baptist, we work on teams. I mean, we have a team-based approach to doing things. And I've heard you talk about creating a cozy team.
Yes.
And when you hear that at face value, you kind of think, sitting around a campfire singing Kumbaya and whatnot. but that's not what you mean. Unpack what a cozy team is.
Sure. So it was the term I gave to when I was on a team and I felt an immense sense of safety, support, and care, even amidst a blizzard outside. So even when something's happening in the market or, you know, in your case, like maybe you have like a really tough patient load or, you know, there's financial troubles or like whatever's happening externally to the team, if you can create a microclimate where you feel like you can talk honestly to each other, you see each other as humans, and you have each other's backs in a way that is, I feel strong and energized. I can pull a little bit more weight today for somebody else who's maybe having a rough day. It feels very much like a dog sled in that way, like we are all pulling at it together. So the name I like the name Cozy because it's so visceral. You can sort of feel what that feels like. And it's what I think is like one of the greatest antidotes to feeling alone at work, to feeling not part of a team. I often say like the worst teams out there are not the teams that are, you know, having trouble with strategy or have too big a workload. The worst teams are the ones that don't feel like a team at all, where you feel like you're in it alone and you don't have people to go at it with you. So cozy teams is a great place to start.
Bree, I really like that. And I like the visceral response of the word cozy. Practically for leaders, I really also like that we put this on leaders. I mean, we talk a lot on this podcast about the importance of leadership and really people that are leaders standing in the gap for their teams. I think our engagement results are really built on putting that onus on leaders. I mean, it's how leaders show up and how they support their teams. And so in that, what are some, I think your book, you kind of unpack some of the practical ways that we can do that. How can leaders and those listening out there, many of which are leaders, many of which are at Baptist, how can they kind of create that environment? Or how do you know when you have that environment?
Yeah. So I can share a few super practical things to do, two tools, and then just a way of showing up. The first tool is something I call a check-in, which is, it's just like a fancy structured way of asking everyone on your team, how are you? And then just listening. That's it. So if you have a stand-up or a regular weekly team meeting, it goes like this. You say, all right, how's everybody doing on a scale of 1 to 5? Put it on your fingers in a second. I'll count down. 3, 2, 1. And everyone puts up a fingers. 2, I'm a 5. And then in 30 seconds each, you just go around the room and say why. So this could be about work or life. So someone might say, you know, I'm a 5. It's my birthday this weekend. My sister is coming in town. We're going to celebrate. Or I'm a 2. I'm actually really worried about this meeting we have coming up. I don't know if we're ready for it. Or I'm a 3. I would have been a 4, but I am wearing 2 different socks. I don't know how that happened. It's these kinds of ritualized moments of humanity that over time create the foundation for a cozy team. It's much easier to feel empathy for someone if you know they're wearing 2 different socks than if you see them as like this professional other and like, oh, they're such an idiot. They don't know what they're doing. So that's one, the check-in.
Hey, Brie, but I love the ritualized humanity. That's a phrase that I really like and will probably stick with us. I mean, I'm a process guy. I love thinking about process and kind of how we can apply kind of processes that are easy to remember. And, you know, that's a great one. So that's a great first tactic.
Yes, because how easy is it to be like, all right, everybody good, let's jump into the agenda, right? And then you just miss all of the context. I could go on about check-ins. There's research on like cognitive offloading, where you like share what's on your mind and then you're more focused in the meeting. Also like thwarting misunderstandings as well. If you're on a Zoom meeting and someone's off camera, if they can say, oh, I threw my back out, that now you care about them. If otherwise, you might be like, why aren't they on camera? What's wrong? Are they not paying attention? Anyway, more there. But so that's one. Also, in terms of ritualized humanity, one of my other favorite tools is called the user manual. This is something that you can do with your team anytime if you haven't done it before. You can sort of refresh once a year. And it's essentially like a guide, a one-page guide to working with you. So literally what it looks like is like a Google document or some sort of shared document. And each person fills out a series of questions. So one, the people or animals most important in my life. Sometimes I find it odd how you can work with someone for years before you find out they have a brother. Like, oh, like it's just important. It's nice to know, you know, what somebody's cat's name is, but also ways of working. Like when I'm stressed or stuck, here's how you can help. Some people want to be smothered with attention and support. Other people really want to be left alone. Or things like how I can be misunderstood, how I deal with change. It's essentially like a quick start guide to working with you. And what I like about it is it accelerates a lot of that team formation stage. Like you can learn these things about someone after working with them for years. But also, why wait? Why not just ask someone like what's important to you on a team and have them say it. So that's another, you can find a template on my website. It's briegroff.com/user-manuals. You can find a template to steal there.
Bri, I've got a question for you about burnout. So
sure. This
has been 10 years ago, we had a discussion about provider burnout, and that could be the frontline nursing staff, physicians, nurse practitioners. And somebody made the comment that, well, you just, you know, we have to develop resiliency. And an invited speaker that came and talked about resiliency in the healthcare workforce. And they made the comment that, you know, these people are like canaries in a coal mine. So do you just need more resilient canaries when they start dropping off? Is that what we need? So how do you deal with the concept of resiliency?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so much to go into here. First of all, my perspective is I think most people feel like, and I agree, it would be nice to not have to be resilient all the time. If we're having to be resilient all the time, maybe the problem is not us. Maybe it's in our context. Maybe it's in the structures or systems that we're operating within. You know, like if you're in the coal mine and there's dangerous gases, like fix those gases, find a different coal mine, you know, don't just say like, why aren't you breathing better? So this is in broad brushstrokes, resiliency is important. I think the question is over what duration and to what extreme are you asking people to be resilient? So I'm going to embarrass myself as a non-medical professional, but hopefully this will resonate with your crowd. I think it's the difference between acute inflammation and chronic inflammation. Acute inflammation, right? Like you cut yourself and then, you know, all of the blood rushes to the cut and there's some inflammation there, and that's good, right? Like your body's rising to the occasion and you say, bravo, body. That to me is fine and healthy and sometimes invigorating at work. If you've got like a big milestone or a deadline or something, you're a big push, a big launch. The problem is really when you're asking for chronic inflammation, when when something in your body is chronically reacting to some sort of stressor, that is damaging long term. Like that, we need to think about what's your environment, what is happening, what's your lifestyle that's creating this chronic inflammation. And so when I think about burnout, to me, burnout is chronic inflammation. And we need to think about the system surrounding it, not necessarily asking people to just be better at being inflamed. I had to stretch the metaphor too far.
That's a great analogy. Bree, you know, one thing about your book says it challenges the notion that professionalism means being buttoned up and overworked. And why, what has happened to us to think that, okay, you know, skipping lunch, working through lunch is a badge of honor, or, you know, being super duper busy. What is that an American culture thing, or what, how do you think that came to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely more so in American culture than, like, say, European culture, as a brief aside. So of my, like, many, many years of consulting in the U.S., whenever I do a workshop with executives, we normally plan a 30-minute lunch. There's some buffet put out, and then we get back into the workshop. Well, I was doing a workshop in Portugal with a company there. We had scheduled our 30-minute lunch, only to be told that day, oh, no, we're sitting down. It'll probably be at least an hour and a half for lunch, and there will be wine. I thought, what? I'm not in Kansas anymore. So it's not everywhere. I think, you know, I live in New York City and probably the epicenter of overworking. It stems from many places. Like, there's our own psychology that in many ways craves to be needed and to feel important. And busyness can sometimes give that validation to us, like the underlying assumption being, if I'm busy, I'm very needed. Busyness can also stem from strategy problems. So when an organization doesn't have a really strong differentiated strategy, like a really clear view of what it does that creates the impact, a lot of companies will default to, like, well, let's just try a bunch of stuff. We've got, like, this project going over here and this initiative and this and that. And so everyone's very busy, but not out of necessity to create a strong, healthy business. It's out of a lack of information, confidence, direction, strong leadership, and strong decision making. That's another culprit. So it comes from many places. But once it's sort of entrenched in the culture that to be seen sitting for an hour, relaxing, heaven forbid, taking a nap, I don't know, like, that is seen as slacking. Once that becomes part of the culture, it then becomes shameful not to overwork. That's when people start to feel like, I have to hide the fact that I have a family or a body, which really, like, and you all know this, what we really want in the knowledge sector is, at least, is for people's brains to work well. And it's actually, like, the research is very clear what makes brains work well. It's like good sleep, nutrition, exercise, good mental health. And yet those are the first things to go straight out the door in an organization that's overworking, right? Like, we're not eating lunch. We're not sleeping well. We're skipping exercise. Don't get me started on mental health if everyone is burnt out. And sure. So really the organization's shooting itself in the foot, because you're actually not honoring the thing that makes your organization work, which is the quality of the humans and the human brains that are working for you.
Hey, Bree, I know, you know, we went through a 100-year pandemic a few years back. And so now we've got a tremendous amount of the workforce that is working remotely. And that's created a little bit of angst. For leaders, managers, that sort of thing. Talk about creating a team microenvironment with half the workforce remote.
Yeah.
A great question or great comment.
It's difficult and not impossible and different. So I'm of two minds when it comes to remote work. On the one hand, like, I personally love an office. I think humans were designed to be in 3D with each other. Obviously, if you are caring for patients, you need to be where the patients are. So like, there are some ways in which like that it's unavoidable. But also, I think it's really joyful to see, to interact in 3D, to have that sort of ease. At the same time, I don't love return to office mandates, not because of the office part, but because of the mandate part. When there are organizational mandates, it's really a question of, it's not even a question of like, where do we work best? It's a question of power. Who decides where I work? Who knows best about where I work? And no one really likes being mandated, you know, having things mandated of them. Like, it affects our sense of autonomy and pride. So in terms of the argument for and against, like, those are some of my thoughts. In a situation where people are already remote, my point of view is that physical distance does not necessarily imply emotional distance. And in fact, some of the closest teams I've ever led were during the pandemic. We weren't in person, and yet we would do things like the check-in every day. We were going through, honestly, the pandemic helped in some ways because we were going through something really profound all together. So leading a hybrid or a virtual team, in many ways, actually, virtual is easier than hybrid. But I think it's being, you have to be a little bit 20% more, in, I don't know, 50% more intentional about how you create that sort of coziness in your team through things like regular check-ins, making sure you don't squeeze all the humanity from your meetings, making sure there are times to come together in person with whatever frequency that is, yearly or monthly. And there's upsides too, like we all experienced during the pandemic, like, oh, I saw your dog in the background and like your kid is back there. There's also upsides to getting to experience people in their homes. And then the obvious upside of people don't have the commutes, caregiving for whoever they're caregiving for is easier, all of those things as well. So you take the good with the bad.
Bree, I want you to, at my own peril, I want you to talk about the do nothing day.
Yes, I would be happy to. So when most people hear this, they're like, it's a bed rot day. I'm going to sit and binge watch Netflix, which is like, you know what? That's a great thing too. Not what I mean by a do nothing day. A do nothing day is essentially an unstructured offsite. A do nothing day is just my cheeky name for it. It stems from a belief, a knowledge rather, that if we want our best, most creative, boldest ideas, we are not designed as humans to have that sort of depth of thought and spark of creativity in a 30-minute meeting. And especially when that 30-minute meeting is our seventh 30-minute meeting of the day. You know, there's a reason why we get our best ideas in the shower. You know, it's one of the few times when we aren't attached to our phones and our hands are busy shampooing or whatnot and our brains can think a little bit. So it's a format in which you would bring together a team for a whole day and commit to producing nothing. Now, usually when I say this, people are like, do nothing days. I need a do everything day. But what it is, it's holding time. You define a challenge or an opportunity ahead of you. So that's why it's good for an offsite. It might be like, how are we approaching, I don't know, for you, like caregivers in our organization, like how are we supporting them? What services do we offer? So maybe that's the topic. And you simply get together as a team. In the book, I offer like a series of some prompts that you can use and you just let the conversation flow. Bonus points if you can go to a park, but there's no write as many ideas as you can in 5 minutes. It's simply, this is going to sound crude, but like think of it as like taking a shower in a group, but you're closed and there's no shower, right? Like you're just giving yourself unstructured time to think. Yeah. And whenever I've done them with teams, the best idea of the project that we're working on have always come from the do nothing days when we've simply allowed the breathing room for our brains.
Hey, Brie, I want to continue on this point because, you know, there's some, and again, I really like the ideas. I love what we're talking about. I think it's really needed and timely. And there's some things that you've said that I really kind of tense up about. You know, sure. Do nothing days is one, kind of naps, you know, the idea of, I mean, you know, and so there's, again, there's this, I guess it's the professionalism side of things and kind of what we're called to do and what we're kind of expected to do. And how we can apply some of that. But you're really talking, I mean, some of this is on personal time, right? Or is all of this kind of, would you advocate for this to be work time? And then maybe, what do you say to the skeptics? Maybe I'm one that's trying to get there. But again, I mean, we're in an organization where that, I mean, I don't know how we would do that.
I get it. So yes to work time. So the do nothing day, if I were to draw it a little closer to business as usual, lots of leadership teams or teams have offsites, right? Sure. The whole idea, right, is to like remove yourself from the day to day and think. All I'm advocating for is taking that one step further and taking out the structure and the rigidity and the focus on production in that time, because really you're doing nothing, but you're thinking everything. So it's really an unstructured brainstorm day. If I were to try and like spin it a little bit closer to like that's something helpful. That feels palatable. Sure. That's all that is. But it's a working day. It's just that you're thinking, you're not making. In terms of something like a nap, this one is such a funny one. Like, you know, most people are like, I wouldn't be caught dead napping at work. Like that just sounds terrible. And yet, like, I've experienced, I think other people have, like, you take a nap when you really need one, maybe 20 minutes, and you wake up so much more refreshed. What my brain goes to then is, for any of these suggestions that make us sort of, like, tense up, and I feel it too, like, you saw my bio, like, I've worked with so many corporate organizations, where my brain goes is, any given idea, is it... Or rather, like any norm that we have in a business, is it performative or is it functional? So when I think of performative professionalism, I think of what are the things that actually don't make us smarter or more effective at our jobs, but we somehow do anyway. So the reason, you know, like wearing a tie might be one. Like, I don't know, you've all worn ties at some point. Like, I imagine they're not fun. Right. Like they do nothing except sort of telegraph some sort of like competency, you know, or in a sweet way, like I've prepared for you, but they don't make you smarter, definitely. So there's those sorts of things around like, oh, I've made my deck look fancy and professional when maybe it's not actually saying anything. So there's sort of like performatively professional things. And then there's functionally professional things. If I'm going to take a 20-minute nap during the workday and then wake up and do the rest of my work better that day, I think that is functionally professional. Because at its heart, what professionalism is doing high quality work on time that achieves some objective or impact. And so if I can structure my days or do work in a way that achieves that, then I think that's professional. So like, if anyone listening to this that can't see, I actually have wet hair right now. And that's because I exercised this morning, came home, had to jump on one call, then showered, then jump on this call. This is not professional, having wet hair in a conversation. And yet my brain works just as well. Like I'm just as smart with wet hair or dry. So I've decided for myself, this is functionally professional. And I don't care about the rest. And so it's a little, the words sometimes help me to distinguish like what is actually unproductive for the business and then what just like feels wrong. Because I feel that too. Yeah. I often feel the like if I was meeting a new client, maybe I would dry my hair. And I get that. We live in the real world.
I do like the definition of performative versus functional performance. And so thank you for clarifying.
And Bree, I have to apologize for those thoughts that were going through my head saying, what's this lady doing with the wet hair on the show? I'm teasing.
No.
But I know, I'm totally teasing. But guys, listen, what a great conversation we've had. Unfortunately, we've got to wrap it up. You know, I know we could talk all day long, Bree. This has been very helpful for me, and I'm sure for our listeners it will be as well. But Bree, on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much. And folks, just remember the book is Today Was Fun, a book about work. And you can find it Amazon or anywhere that you get your books. There's also a Kindle version as well for those who like the electronic versions. But anyway, once again, Bree, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you for all of the really good work you do for your patients and your communities. And I hope you're having fun while you're doing it.